Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, have you ever seen or heard an Ignite Seattle event? If not, you should. The organizers always find and present people we should be hearing from, people who may live down the street, people who care enough, petrified or not, to get up on a stage and share their passion. In this excerpt, we're presenting a selection of talks from Ignite Seattle 30 that fit into our KUOW broadcast. If you'd prefer to hear the full program of great talks, scroll over to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Ignite Seattle 30 took place on May 26th at Town Hall Seattle. The MC was Scott Birkin. Please note, this recording contains language of an adult nature.
So our first talk, the honorable first slot, Nicolette Newman is going to talk about fantastic bees and where to find them. Please welcome Nicolette to the stage.
All right, so thank you all for coming. My name is Nicolette, and I'm going to talk to you about fantastic bees and where to find them. Before I start talking about bees, I do want to clear up one misconception about bees. They are not terrifying and scary. They're not death bees, as some would like to call them. They won't go out of their way to sting you. All they want to do is forage and find nectar and pollen, and they will stay away from you if you stay away from them. I actually find them really adorable, kind of cute. You might think differently, but now bees, when I say the word bees, most of you are probably thinking of honeybees, which is completely understandable. They're the most well-known, most popular kind of bee that you'll see around, and that's because we eat the honey that they produce, and they're also really important for agriculture. They pollinate in some way or another about 30% of the food that we eat. So honeybees are transported all over the country to pollinate kind of one crop after another. However, honeybees are not native to the United States. They are pollinators of majority, or they pollinate a lot of these agricultural crops, but they were not originally here. There were native pollinators that were doing that job long before they arrived. Honeybees were introduced to the United States by Europeans in about the 1600s when they arrived on the continent. So these native bees, they are undergoing some of the similar problems to what honeybees are, these declines. We've seen a few issues with honeybees in our local area, especially last year was when that giant semi-truck full of bees tipped over. So there's a lot of issues going on that we hear about with bees. I don't really want to dwell on those issues, but I do want to introduce you to some kinds of native bees that we have in this area in the Northwest. There's some pretty good puns that we got out of this bee spill as well. So a lot of these native bees that we have in the Northwest are doing this job of pollination, and we don't really see it. So the first kind of native bee that you'll probably recognize are bumblebees. I think bumblebees are really awesome. They are they form a colony similar to what honeybees do, a lot smaller. The difference is, though, that bumblebees will send off queens at the end of the summer to go eat and forage on nectar, and those queens actually hibernate over the winter. They go into something called diapause, where their body metabolism slows down, and then they come out again in the spring, lay a bunch of eggs, and establish new colonies. Bumblebees are also really awesome because they perform a special service called buzz pollination. Buzz pollination is really unique. What the bee does will grab onto the anther of the flower, which is the part that holds the pollen, and vibrate really, really quickly at a really high frequency to knock the pollen loose. So it's almost like a tuning fork. If you were to hit a tuning fork and watch how quickly it vibrates, that's how quickly a bumblebee will vibrate its muscles to do this buzz pollination. Another kind of native bee that we have in the area that's really important to us, particularly in Washington for our economy, are mason bees. And that's because apples are very important in Washington. I love apples. I love eating them. I'm sure a lot of you do too. And for our economy, especially over around Wenatchee area, that's a hugely important crop. And apples are pollinated by blue orchard bees, which is a kind of mason bee. You can see they look really different from any other kind of bee that you would normally imagine. And they're also solitary. They don't form colonies or hives like honeybees and bumblebees do. They forage on their own and lay their own eggs and raise their own larvae individually. Another kind of native bee, this large family, are the Halictidae, or the sweat bees. And this is an example of a sweat bee, this green metallic bee, really pretty, another solitary bee. And the sweat bee family gets their name because they actually are attracted to the taste of human sweat. So if they land on you, they will treat you kind of like a salt lick. They're so small that you can't feel it. It's not like a giant bumblebee or honeybee landing on you. They're very, very tiny. It's not really intimidating, but it's kind of fun. They like to come and lick on your skin. So a lot of the questions that come to me when I'm talking about bees with people are, what can we do to help bees? Because we all see how there are all these problems that bees are dealing with. And so if you're a gardener, then you're probably already doing a lot to help bees just by planting flowers, providing nectar and pollen. The number one rule, I'd say, is to plant a variety of colors. So different bees have different preferences of flowers. If you were eating the same food every day, you'd get really bored of it. Same with bees. So planting a variety of colored flowers ensures that you have a variety of food sources for them. Also think about the flower shape. You have really, really tiny solitary bees. You have pretty big bumblebees. Certain bee sizes can't fit into really tiny tubular flowers. So also having a variety of flower shapes is a really helpful trick. So if you're interested in helping out bees and want to know more information, I would recommend the Xerxes Society. They have a ton of resources. You're also free to contact me, and you can come see me in the intermission as well if you have any more questions. Thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Good job. So Nicolette has provided you all with a kit underneath your seat. Just reach under and tap up, and a swarm of sweat bees will be released. Up to you, though. Up to you. Next up is How to Gig Economy by Sarah Squire. Please give her a round of applause.
Hi, my name is Sarah Squire. As Scott said, I'm the CEO and janitor of a company I started last year called Engage Identity. It's called Engage Identity because I have an unhealthy obsession with Captain Picard. The best captain. I do consulting, training, and software development on identity-based internet protocols like OAuth, and I'm here tonight to tell you how to succeed at being your own boss. So my first piece of advice is to drink with nerds. That's how I got my first client. I was working at the University of Washington in the IT department in a cubicle, and they sent me to a bunch of conferences where I talked to people about projects they're hacking on and problems they're having right now. And I found ways that I could help them out. So ultimately, getting clients is about making friends with people who need help. So once I made those friends, I started my own company, and I started moonlighting. That was just over a year ago. By December, I was working for myself about 20 hours a week on top of my full-time job, and I was getting burned out. So I went to my biggest client, and I asked them to bump up my hours. And they said yes. They would love to. And so I quit my job. It was terrifying. But looking back, I realized that my fear was baseless. So I think we all agree that when you invest money, you don't put it all in one place. You diversify your assets. But we have this conception that diversifying your labor is somehow riskier than working a full-time job. So raise your hand if you know someone who's been laid off from a full-time job. Yeah, that is terrifying. So full-time jobs are security theater. You have a consistent income stream, but your income streams are less diverse. Any one of my clients can drop me, and I'll still be okay. So I got over that logical objection to this plan as a possibly very bad life decision, and I still had this feeling that, oh my God, I don't know what I'm doing, my clients are gonna leave, I'm gonna lose my apartment, it rains a lot in Seattle, and I will be wet and cold. And I realized, you know what, not knowing what I'm doing is a good thing. Smart people like the ones in this room love jumping into the deep end of the pool and learning how to swim. We get bored when we know what we're doing. So I stopped that cycle by starting it. I still think to myself, oh God, I don't know what I'm doing. But now I think, and that's exactly how I want it to be. So I have a slate full of amazing clients. I'm doing the work that I love, but the only place I can work is my apartment. Who knows where this is going? Yeah, yeah. I am not the kind of person who can work from home. I would go feral and stop speaking English. It's not pretty. I need to be around people who can smell me. And there's no way yet to add smell to a Git commit message. I need a schedule. I need a way to separate work life from home life. So I joined a co-working space. This is Coterie Work Lounge on 4th and Union. Yes, it has an actual lounge in it. That's my friend Jessie at the end of the bar with the pink hair. She's a Python developer. This is Armin, our bartender. So I can still drink with nerds, but now I do it at work. I love this place. I love coming here every day. I love bouncing ideas off of people and making new friends. And it's not that expensive, which brings me to my next piece of advice. Don't be afraid to talk about money. You have to ask for what you're worth and be willing to walk away from clients who won't give it to you. Don't be shy about asking people who do what you do how much they charge. Don't be afraid to ask your clients what their budget is and work out a way to get their project done and your rent paid. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you that actually making enough money to pay rent in Seattle is no mean feat, which brings me to the topic of failure. So I made some bad contract decisions when I was first starting out. I made the mistake on one project of saying, yeah, I can build you an API, no problem, flat rate. But what I didn't realize was that when I said build, I meant it's outputting the right things. And when they said build, they meant we can call you 10 times a day and change the spec. I had to fire that client when we got to the point where they called me and they said, we need you to put a logo on the back-end API that you built. You can't, it's a back-end, there's no way, you can't do that. My last piece of advice is don't apologize for needing help. Don't say sorry, say thank you. Don't say, oh, I'm really sorry, but I need this report from you tomorrow. Say, I need this report from you tomorrow. Thank you so much for helping me. Don't say sorry, say thank you. Thank you for being a wonderful audience.
Good job. Next up, different direction for you. Tiny particles can change the world. Charlie Corridor, please give him a round of applause.
Okay, so I'm one of the nerds that she was referring to. So my name is Charlie Corridor, and I'm an atomic hacker. And I'm so excited to be here with you and share a topic that is really dear to me, how tiny particles can actually change the world, or nanotechnology. Many of us think about nanotechnology, about this mythical creature that is going to come and destroy us within the next 20 years. But let me tell you, that is not true. In fact, that's only what media has been feeding us during the past 20 years. So let me tell you that actually nanotechnology is everywhere. In fact, there are over 1,800 commercial products right now that you can purchase in the market, and they contain, have been made, have been exposed, or actually have been introduced to nanotechnology. So today, if you had a coffee with 2% milk, let me tell you, you consume titanium dioxide nanoparticles. Yes, you did. So we scientists, physicists, and engineers are actually using nanotechnology to make these products stronger, faster, better for you, and more affordable. And you might ask, what is actually nanotechnology? Well, nanotechnology is the science and where we physicists and engineers actually employ and modify matter at the atomic scale. Really exciting stuff. And within the atomic scale and this nanotechnology, we use this unit called nanoscale. And a nanoscale or a nanometer is actually, to give you a frame of reference, if you have a meter long of a metallic rod and you divide it by a billion times, that tiny piece that you're actually collecting, that's one nanometer. And to give you more information about a more reference, our DNA has a diameter of 2.9 nanometers. Our red blood cells that they're running in our blood right now actually has a diameter of somewhere around 7,000 to 8,000 nanometers. That is really exciting stuff that I'm working on. And why nanotechnology? Well, because all the physics and chemistry that we learn in the macro world, the world that we live, doesn't apply to the nanoscale, right? There are unique properties that we scientists are employing to solve one of the global challenges, which is energy, food, climate change, the economy, healthcare, and environment. And tonight, I'm going to talk about two problems that I'm working on with nanotechnology to solve them. So remember that I said that there are over 1,800 commercial products in the market that they contain nanotechnology or contain nanoparticles. Well, let me ask you, what happens when these products go to the landfills? Well, highly percentage of these nanoparticles are going to leach out of these products. They're going to go to the water treatment plants. Then, because they're so small, the water treatment plants, they're not be able to filtrate them, so they're going to go back to our rivers. And we scientists are employing a large amount of our efforts using these complicated tools that not even Tony Stark can actually use to understand what is the environmental impact of nanotechnology to the environment. This is really interesting question, but I took a different approach as a scientist. I developed a simple, sensitive, and affordable technology to detect nanoparticles in environmental matrices, everything from the ocean, from the lakes, from the rivers, from the soil. So this technology is so simple, they use the catalytic activities of nanoparticles. That was the first problem that I tried to solve with nanotechnology. The second one is healthcare. One of the biggest problems that we have is detecting viruses and pathogens within the single visit that you go to the doctor. So let me propose to you a problem. You're in pain. You're suffering because you wanna you have this illness that you don't know what it is. Well, the doctor actually take the sample that he took from you. They send it to a centralized lab, right? The centralized lab will take somewhere around 72 to 48 hours to get back to the doctor. The doctor trying to get back to you. This is a big hurdle for them. So I actually use the simple approach to solve this problem. So I use the technology from lateral flow or the pregnancy test with battery and with assistance of nanotechnology to make this sensitive, fast, an affordable technology that is able to detect any pathogen and any virus with a single visit. This is really exciting, right? Because actually I can help the world with nanotechnology. And now let me tell you how I do it. Actually, I'm using gold nanoparticles. As you can see, gold is no gold. It's red right now. And I'm making these spheres, and I functionalize them, or I coat them with a polymer or a protein that is specific to the virus or pathogen that we're trying to detect, right? And because we're doing that, we increase the sensitivity by 100 times. And this is only one or two of the examples that I've been working on nanotechnology. If you guys want to know more about nanotechnology, you're excited about the new frontier about nanotechnology, feel free to reach out to me. I'm really excited, and thank you for being a great audience, and have a fantastic Ignite talk today. Thank you.
Next up is a talk with a different flavor. The talk is titled, I Am Your Muslim Neighbor. Please welcome. Wow. All right. You're clearly in the right neighborhood. Please welcome Amanda Saab to the stage.
I have to be completely honest, this is a little bit more nerve-wracking than cooking with Gordon Ramsay, but we'll get to that a little bit later. My name's Amanda Saab. I'm 27 years old, and I'm a social worker. I have two younger sisters, Dina and Mona. Mona's here tonight. Hey. So I am your Muslim neighbor, and when you think of Muslims, you might think of a stereotypical desert-dwelling, bearded, camel-riding Arab man. That's just one of the things the media likes to throw out there. I'm here to say that Muslims are coming from all across the globe, representing every ethnicity and every race. American Muslims have no majority race, according to the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. I'm going to be focusing on American Muslim women who have inspired me and touching a little bit about my own story. American Muslim women are making contributions every single day, whether they be doctors caring for the sick, journalists, telling captivating stories, or Ibtihaj Muhammad, who will be representing Team USA in Rio de Janeiro in the Summer Olympic Games. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. We're making history every single day, and we are living in our neighborhoods. We live next door to you. So a Gallup poll of 2009 on American Muslims found that American Muslim women were the second highest educated group of religious women in the United States, and we're just as likely as American Muslim men to have a college degree or higher. This is my family. So when talking about American Muslims, I'd like to touch on the hijab. My mother and I have decided to wear the hijab, while my sisters have decided not to. It's really important that we address the issue of hijab because many feel that it is oppressive. As a teenager, I questioned everything my parents said, like most teenagers do. I questioned their authority and even my faith. I set out to find the truth for myself. I read and read and read some more and found that Islam not only welcomed questions, but encouraged it. The hijab is my feminist statement, and I made the decision to wear it when I was 16 years old. It is part of my identity and my way of telling the world and myself that my faith and devotion to God are above societal standards of beauty. Now, inspired by my faith, I decided to become a social worker. The Prophet Muhammad said to care for the poor and needy, and that's one of the pillars of Islam. And I wanted to ensure that I was able to do that every single day in my career. Fast forward, my husband Hussein and I moved to the beautiful Pacific Northwest, had to do a little adjusting to the 363 days of rain, began eating granola, taking public transportation, and embraced this ice-cold Seattle freeze. Due to the challenges of my career, I turned to food writing to process all the traumas of my day. That led me to compete on MasterChef, because, you know, cooking for Gordon Ramsay on national television is always a good idea. Thank you. Thank you. I earned a MasterChef apron and was one of the first American Muslim women wearing hijab to do so. And that got a lot of press. That also got a lot of hate comments. I chose to not ignore them, like some of them said, just block. I rather chose to challenge their hate and understand why and where it was coming from. Now, Islamophobia is a really serious issue and has led to the deaths of three beautiful, intelligent young Muslim Americans in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It is devastating to know that people like me can be murdered because of their faith. I decided to take that ignorance and hate and turn it into something positive. So I began Dinner with Your Muslim Neighbor. My husband and I opened our home to our colleagues, neighbors, and complete strangers to talk about Islam in a safe, judge-free environment. No silly questions, no judgments, free for everyone, and of course I was cooking, so delicious food. I believe that food can be the bridge to understanding and can really bring people together. We can use food to talk about things. It helps set the tone. I wish we kind of had more food here tonight because I'd probably be a little bit less nervous. Now, here's our point. What can you do? Well, reach out. Break bread with your neighbors. Say hello. Extend a helping hand. Together, we can be the change we want to see in the world, and we can be the ideal neighborhood that we wish to see and all strive for every single day. So I, and all of these wonderful people are your Muslim neighbors. So when you see us, give us a friendly hello, a smile, join us for dinner. You're welcome at our place. And I hope to see you guys sometime in the future. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
So next up, different direction again. We'll talk a little bit about parenting, a special kind of parenting. You're going to hear an engineer's guide to foster parenting by Kevin Moore. Please welcome Kevin to the stage.
I'm not an introvert, I'm memeing. Hi. Engineers live in a world of acronyms and memes. If you don't know what this means, you don't waste enough time on the internet. Or you should watch Office Space again, it's a really good movie. Me and my wonderful wife, we are dinks. Dual income, no kids. We had this wonderful experience in Europe. My wife did a volunteer thing, I should talk better about it, in Romania at an orphanage. And we decided that there's so many kids in the world that need love, and we thought about growing our family via adoption. And so obviously we have stereotypes about how adoption works. And when you talk about adoption, this is how most people think about it, right? But there's another option, which is foster to adopt. And this is what my wife and I learned about and got into. There's 400,000 children in the United States right now in foster care, and 100,000 of them are looking for a permanent home, what we call a forever home. And my wife and I realized with 10,000 kids in the state of Washington, this is something we wanted to help with. So we dug in. We took many hours of classes. We became CPR and what is the other one? Yeah, that thing, you know. I know how the AED thing works with the shocking, and it's really scary and cool. And we got a placement in January. So before I start, I need to do a little CYA, which is... I've only been doing this for 4 months, and I'm brand new to it. I know many of you probably have many kids, doing it for many years. This is my experience. I'm not claiming to be an expert, so cut me a little slack. Second of all, privacy is a big part of this, so I can't show you any pictures of our cute little one. He is way more cute than this puppy. I just wanted to give a basis for kind of comparison. So you know. My first piece of advice, RTFM. You don't have to make it up. You don't have to copy what your parents did or do the opposite of what your parents did. A wonderful researcher at UW has been studying this for decades. She's done great research on it. She's written books. I would highly recommend that book. Like, there is good science here. Really good science. And what's great about this is my wife and I are literally on the same page. Like, there's no disagreements about this is how I was raised versus you. Like, we have a basis to go to, and it's really, really good. And so a lot of the things I've learned come from this. So what do consequences and vaccines have in common? I would love to tell you, but my wife said I get beat up in Seattle. But consequences are super, super important for kids. Like, reality is full of consequences, and so we need to teach them that. Part of that is, like, not reacting to negative stimulus. Your children will try to get your attention in bad ways. You're better off ignoring. Don't laugh, and maybe, and they're not breaking anything, don't chastise them. Just ignore them. Give them no signal. They'll learn that's not a way to get attention. More importantly, do not let them negotiate. They will scream. They will yell. They might embarrass you. Do not give in. They will learn that is a way to get their way. And part of how to make that successful is slowing down. What you realize is you can't rush a three-year-old. You can't rush a toddler. And a lot of times when they're trying to do those things to get your attention, maybe they just need some attention, and you need to slow down and think about that. A great example happened. I was doing a project outside. I asked him if he wanted to help. He said yes. And he kept, like, digging through my tools and playing with all the sharp things. And I realized I didn't have anything for him to do because I was working on what I was doing. So I got out a piece of wood, and I taught him how to hammer. And, of course, he wanted me to hold the nail, which I thought was perfect. And I was like, no. Good lessons to learn. And sometimes you just need to be creative. She approved this picture, by the way. Like, she didn't want to wear diapers. She made up this wonderful game about, like, put a diaper on your head, and it became a joke, and he put on his diapers. So sometimes you just need to be really creative. And so some combination of lots of patience and time and creativity, you get this wonderful synergy where things get really good. You laugh a lot together with your partner, and it makes things much, much easier. And even beyond that, there's kind of a few other things. Pick your battles. Like, if the kid's not eating with a fork and not eating the vegetables, pick one. Like, don't make it about, like, you will eat vegetables with a fork. Like, fingers are fine. Like, get the broccoli down first. We'll work on the fork later. And don't be afraid about getting help. Get babysitters. There are these great places called Playdate. They have, like, bumper, like, places for kids to play, and they serve alcohol. Seriously, I had no idea this existed. It's the most beautiful thing in the world. I dropped off the little guy at school today, and he held my leg, and he says, "I miss you," and it was just the most sweet thing. And he grabbed my badge, and he looked at it, and he's like, I remember your face in my head," and I just almost collapsed. It is the most meaningful thing I do in my life. It's really wonderful. The short version, this is the organization that we have been working on for Foster Adopt. There's so many kids in this world, in this city, in this state that need our love and help, and you can help them. Please look deeper if you're at all curious. Thank you so much.
Great job. That was excellent. Would you adopt me? I've had a rough time with these Ignite organizers. They're so mean to the MC. You have no idea. Okay. So our next talk, in a non-juxtaposed sort of connectedness theme, is about parenting. But it goes a little deeper. It's a little bit more serious talk, but I think you're going to be amazed and inspired, challenged, but amazed and inspired by this talk. The talk's title is called "The Skin We're In." Please welcome Fess Naqvi to the stage. Fess.
Mom, Dad, it hurts. It really, really hurts. Please make it stop. These are the words that no parent or caretaker wants to hear. And we've had to hear them since our daughter was born in 2012. And they have been the source of much frustration and anger and sadness and rage within us, and I'll tell you why. Skin is the largest organ in the human body. On an average human, it spans about 21 square feet in length and weighs about 9 pounds. It helps regulate body temperature, It's made up of collagen and keratin, and it's made up of three layers, the epidermis, dermis, and the hypodermis. It's a primary organ for making sure that everything inside your body is protected from outside diseases and infections. So, what happens when things go wrong? Well, there's 583 possible scenarios. Why 583? Because the National Institute of Health lists 583 possible infections, diseases, or disorders one can have on their skin. And this brings me to my story. In 2012, in an unexpected surprise, me and my wife found out that we were expecting. We were really happy. We were going to try at the end of the year, but it happened earlier, and we were overjoyed. Everything went great. Her pregnancy, the delivery and labor process, and her daughter was beautiful. But there's always a but. A few hours after she was born, we noticed that the skin on her feet was really red, and the redness was not subsiding. And a little bit later, she was blistering head to toe. A physician was called, and she diagnosed her with EB, or epidermolysis bullosa, which skin biopsies later confirmed. The last 3.5 years have been filled with battles, filled with diluted bleach and vinegar baths, of wound care, of skin care, of trying not to hurt our kid while we're doing skin care. Fear, anger, rage, not knowing what to do next. You see, epidermolysis bullosa is a rare genetic skin disorder that causes your skin to blister, shred, or tear. And on some, this touch will make their skin fall off. And to this day, our 3.5-year-old blisters head to toe, inside her mouth, on her genitals. And for some, it causes strictures and closures of the esophageal tract, and for that, they need a G-tube for feeding. You see, it's so rare that it's 1 in 20,000 to 1 in 50,000 rare. And for some, it can be terminal or fatal. And there is no cure. Yeah, you heard me right. There is no cure. There's only long-term pain management and wound care, which we continue to do and other parents and caretakers continue to do. So, aside from having anger management issues and having possible PTSD issues and being mentally and physically exhausted and going to a father's group for special needs kids once a month, I learned a few things along the way. I learned and I continue to learn to love unconditionally. I'm trying to learn patience. I'm trying not to judge others on their anger and sadness and not telling them how to smile, because why? Everyone carries a burden. Who am I to judge them on what they're feeling? You see, there's a lack of empathy and sympathy in this world, and there's getting to be a lack of tolerance, and I really don't want to spread any more of that. I'd rather have us, you know, work towards a better world and just make it better for not just for our kids, for generations after. I want to be comfortable in my skin, you see, and I hope one day with the help of research, my daughter and others like her can be comfortable in hers, in theirs. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's a brave thing to get on any stage in any situation and to talk about something like that. I'm in awe and impressed by that. Another round of applause for Fess, please. Thank you. Take a second for yourself. Because life is hard, and part of Ignite, we realize shouldn't all be fun and games. Part of why we invite people who have serious things to talk about. It's not the first time we've heard serious personal stories up here. We think that's a healthy thing because it's a big part of life. But I'm a selfish person. My job now is to segue to the next talk.
Next talk is titled, Bluefin Tuna Are Badass Fish. Please welcome Mark Vandekamp up on stage.
Bluefin tuna are awesome. And I don't mean sort of cool, kind of neat awesome. I mean inspiring feelings of awe and great admiration awesome. When I first learned about bluefin tuna, I didn't really think this. I thought they were sort of boring fish, kind of big-headed. Look, you can draw them with three curved lines. But then I started to learn about bluefin tuna, and I changed my mind. And I'm going to tell you some of the things I learned. First of all, bluefin are huge animals. An average adult bluefin is longer than I am tall and weighs more than the biggest sumo wrestler. A really big bluefin is more than 10 feet long and weighs as much as a smart car. And these fish are athletes. A bluefin literally never stops swimming. It'll suffocate if it swims slower than a walking speed for you and me, and it usually swims at about 8 miles an hour, and that's twice as fast as Michael Phelps can swim a 100-meter butterfly. And they're not just swimming around in circles. These fish migrate back and forth across entire oceans. In one scientific study, there was a tagged tuna named Terry who swam 25,000 miles in less than 2 years, going back and forth across the Pacific. So that's what they do when they're just cruising along. But when they're in attack mode, a tuna turns into an aquatic missile. Its dorsal fin retracts into a groove on its back, and its pectoral fins fold back into grooves on its side, making it perfectly streamlined. In this configuration, a bluefin can burst forward at over 40 miles an hour. That's twice as fast as a bottlenose dolphin at top speed. So these fish do extraordinary things. But what's the most extraordinary thing about them is how they do those things. You see, a bluefin tuna is a warm-blooded fish. Now, when I first heard that, I went, wait, what? Mammals are warm-blooded, birds are warm-blooded, fish are cold-blooded. And there's a reason why the vast majority of fish are cold-blooded, and that's because fish breathe water. Their blood absorbs oxygen from the water rushing past their gills. The problem with that system is that water absorbs heat 24 times better than air does. So in a standard cold-blooded fish, their muscles produce heat, just like yours or mine. But the heat goes into the blood goes to the gills serve as radiators, they transfer that heat, and the fish's body temperature is the same as the water around them. Well, what about bluefin tuna? They use a lot of oxygen, and in fact, they have up to 30 times the gill area of other fish. Well, bluefin have evolved a heat exchange system called a rete mirabile, which means miraculous net in Latin, and this is how it works. In a bluefin, the cold, oxygenated blood leaving the gills doesn't run down the center of the fish through its core. Instead, the arteries split and run on each side just underneath the skin, far away from the warm core of the fish. Then, where the artery branches off and each branch goes toward the center of the fish, that blood vessel runs right next to the vein that's bringing the warm, deoxygenated blood outward. That network of blood vessels serves as a countercurrent heat exchanger, and the tuna's nervous system can regulate it to maintain a near constant body temperature. It's up to 99% efficient. And the bottom line of that is that a tuna swimming in 50-degree water off the coast of California can have a core body temperature of 85 degrees. Now, being warm-blooded is a huge deal if you're a predatory fish. Bluefin tuna hunt particularly effectively in the areas where cold, nutrient-rich water wells up from the bottom of the ocean, sparking an explosion of life all the way up the food chain. In those cold waters, a bluefin has an advantage over its prey because its warm eyes see better, its warm muscles produce more power, and its warm nervous system is more coordinated. Being warm-blooded is what makes bluefin tuna badass fish. So I've reached the point in virtually every nature talk where I tell you that humans are terrible and we're killing off the animals and they're threatened or endangered. And yeah, humans can be pretty terrible. And we are overfishing the bluefin tuna, particularly in the Atlantic. But I don't want to leave you with that. I don't want to leave you feeling sad or guilty about bluefin tuna. What I hope instead is that by telling you about these highly evolved animals, that I've shared some of the sense of wonder that I felt as I learned about them, and that you'll agree with me that bluefin tuna are truly awesome.
Great job. Thank you. The thing I want to know is, like, what fish is out there that's just terrible, that there's nothing good about it so we can feel good about eating it? Like what's the trump of fish? You know, that we can get like, yeah, let's get rid of it, get eliminated. And that's maybe a future Ignite talk. There may not be a fish for this. I don't know. Maybe it's tofu. Tofu's the trump of, anyway. Bad segue. Let me move on. So there's a lot of buzz. I am a middle-aged person. I was born in 1972. I'm older than many of you. My eyesight's not very good, so I actually can't really tell. But there's a lot of consternation about the next generation. I was born in Generation X, and there's a Y and a Z, and now there's millennials. A lot of talk about this. So I feel very honored. We're going to have a millennial talk about millennials. The title of our talk is Why the World Hates Millennials. Please welcome Cameron Barnes to the stage.
Hit it, Larry. Have you ever forgotten to put an important date in your iPhone and realized you were going to take the L? Have you ever had one of those days where your outfit was on fleek, but then you forgot to take a picture? And have you ever been sorry, not sorry, while talking to a friend? Or have you ever gotten V embarrassed because your friend sent an ugly Snapchat of you to your bae? Well, if you answered yes to any of these questions, you're probably a millennial. But if you thought I was speaking gibberish, you're definitely not. And if you're a millennial, I hate to break it to you, but the world hates you. Hi, everyone. I'm Cameron Barnes, and I was born on March 19th, 1998. So this means that I, too, am a millennial. So why, you might ask, would I write a speech about how awful my own generation is? Well, the answer is quite simple. Because somebody has to say it. Now, keep in mind that these aren't the ravings of a scorned girl shunned by her peers. I like my classmates. But these are observations. I was the Jane Goodall of my high school, and my classmates were the chimps. Observation one focuses a lot on community service, or more specifically, the lack of passion while doing said community service. So if you were a senior that had to do civics hours and volunteered at an elementary school dance or carnival, I'm going to guess you spent about half your time figuring out how to do the least amount of work possible, and the other half of your time figuring out how much free food you could snag before they realized it was you. See, the problem with this is that there's no passion involved unless you're really into being lazy. And we do better, more considerate work when it's a cause we care about. So if we're putting in 50% of the effort rather than 110%, how do you think that looks to adults? I'll tell you, we look like bums. We do better work when we care about it. So whether it's Little League or working with animals, we need to find things that we actually give a damn about, because then our work actually means something. We need to do it for the experience and not the hours. Observation two focuses on how millennials continue to do idiotic things. Exhibit A being how these six girls in Arizona decided to spell out the N-word on their shirts and put it on social media. I don't think I need to say anything more about that. It's also 2016 and people still litter. Just because our bedrooms are disgusting doesn't mean the world needs to be. The world is gross and we need to do our part to help clean it up. And if you can't walk 10 feet away to throw your McDonald's bag, then I sense a weight issue in your future. And our tough guy language that makes us feel cool actually makes us sound like a-holes. You don't need every other word out of your mouth to be the F-word or call someone a highly offensive name just to assert your dominance. Pee on them already so we can move on and sound like educated young adults. And your souped-up Honda Civic sounds like a weed whacker. Your racing is dangerous and you're going to hurt yourself or someone else around you, and then you're really going to regret it. And millennials are under the impression that learning is not cool, and that's really just not the case. So when you don't do the homework and text the diligent kids for the 32nd time asking to copy the math homework, they're not going to feel bad for you when you get a D on the test. School may not be cool, but neither is living in a society full of people who choose a leader based off his selfie game and spray tans. So So now that we know we're awful, what can we do? Well, luckily, my dear millennials, we are not too far gone. What we need to do is start helping each other. So millennials, if you see your friends being morons, let them know. Tell them to knock it off. If you see trash, pick it up. Be a good citizen. Now, if you're not a millennial, you have a slightly different task. You see, these scruffy, apathetic millennials that I've been in school with for the past 13 years, they're gonna grow up to take care of you. So it is in your best interest to start showing them how to be better leaders. Because it is with your wisdom and your experiences that we can start learning how to take care of the world and start taking care of it well. And I'm gonna let you in on a little secret. Millennials don't like being told what to do. So it's with this in mind that I beg you to lead by example. Show us how to take care of the world. Show us how to be good people, and show us how to do the right thing, and show us how to take this world and make it a better place so that we can take the job that you've done and do something even better with it. We can't change everybody's actions. We can only do our best to be leaders. So if you do a good thing, someone will see you, and then the rest will come, like this guy dancing, if you haven't seen that video. All you can do is change your own actions. So, my dear millennials, it's great to be a kid, but at 17, you need to start preparing for adulthood. In conclusion, don't be an idiot. The world is watching, and they hate you.
Great job. I think that was really good advice, not just for millennials, but for people my age, too. Something to keep in mind. Last note, again, volunteer organization. If you had fun tonight, tell people about it. Post about it on Facebook. The talk you liked the most. The one you thought was the worst. That the MC guy had annoying red pants. Whatever you like to say, tell people about this event so we can keep doing it, make it better and better every time we do it. Next event's in October. Submissions are open right now. So if you have an idea, go up there, start reading about our advice. Thank you. Good night. Have a great long weekend. It's a pleasure. Thank you for coming. Thank you.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks for listening. Tune in again soon.